Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. Today is a Throwback Thursday episode. Excuse my dog, he's walking in the background. But before we jump in, I wanted to remind you we have an adventure grant going right now. We're going to close the application February 22nd. If you or anyone you know is doing an adventure this year and they need some funding, we're giving away three grants, $1,000, $500, and $250 plus gear. And, you know, it's for anyone doing an adventure in 2023. Have them apply. We're going to be giving it away to somebody, and you might have a pretty good chance of getting it. I'm just going to say that. So, you know, apply, submit what you want to do. And also, this episode is great. I remember this being one of the first episodes I edited, so my editing skills have improved a lot since then. The sound quality is okay on this one, but I remember Pete being so inspiring because at the time I was kind of a part-time stay-at-home dad as well, and so I got a lot of inspiration from Pete, and I just loved his name, Pete Ripmaster. Pretty cool. So let's hear this story. It was so inspiring, so cool, and let's go ahead and jump in.
Hey friends, I have an incredible guy with us today. His name is Peter Ripmaster, and Peter is an ultra-distance runner, but he says he doesn't want to be identified first as just an ultra-distance runner. He wants to be identified as an adventurer first who does ultra-distance running, but when I say ultra-distance, this is going to blow your mind. You remember that little dog sled race up in Alaska that's over 1,000 miles long? Did you know that people run that too? Now, I'm not talking about a 50-miler or a 100-miler. We're talking about a 1,000-mile run. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kurt, for having me.
I tell you what, when I first heard that people run the Iditarod, I was blown away. So I just, well, let's rewind just a little bit. We're going to get back to the Iditarod, Peter, but let's find out who you are, okay? So Asheville, North Carolina, that's where you live with your wife and two girls.
Yes.
You are also a public speaker. What else would you like to tell us about yourself?
I've always just been an outdoorsman. I mean, I honestly think, you know, adventure outdoorsman, I don't worry too much about titles of what things is. I just love being out in the woods. Before I did any running or ultras or anything like that, it was about mountaineering and rock climbing and telemark skiing and ice climbing and just any pursuit that you can be out in the woods, I'm all about. And I'm also an advocate for other people to do whatever gets them off the couch.
Nice. And well, you live in the right place if you like those sorts of sports. Asheville, North Carolina, pretty nice.
We're trying to be quiet about that, you know, as much as we humanly can, because it's pretty special place. But yeah, my wife and I have been here for about a dozen years, and boy, it's home. After spending all types of time out west and up north, I just never would guess that North Carolina would be my home. But these mountains and Asheville are just, it's just a great, great place to live, a very diverse place, and I'm happy here.
That's neat. So how did you first get into the idea of doing a long run?
I got into running first and foremost to raise money for cancer research. After losing I lost my mom to breast cancer in 2000 and went through a bunch of difficult years after that where running distance races was the furthest thing from my mind. I just went through some dark times. And then when I met my wife and I kind of got back on my two feet, I realized that I wanted to do something big to raise money. So I started running marathons, and I ended up running 50 marathons in 50 states. And that kind of, like, you know, started thinking. And then towards the end of that project, I just wanted to think if I could go further and further and further, like you hear a lot of people talk about. I always wanted to press a little bit further just to see where that line is of what's possible. And so ultimately it led to Alaska. But, you know, there's many, many stories before that as well.
Wow. So you've been doing this for a while. How long have you been doing these big runs?
I have been running for a decade of my life, but like I said, there was probably a decade before that of a lot of pursuits outside. I lived out in Telluride, Colorado for many, many years and explored all those mountains around there and just had a ton of fun in the mountains before I And then, again, when I started running, it wasn't necessarily that I adored it. I just was raising money for research. And then as it kind of whittled away, I realized that it was really good for me. And also, it was really good for – I've dealt with depression my whole life, and I found that running – it was a really good outlet for me to feel comfortable and to think through things and just have some quiet time with myself. And so it was kind of a spiritual component to my outdoor activities as well.
Well, do you mind if we dive into that a little bit? I'd like to hear more. Do you think is it just the time alone that helped with, you know, sorting things out? Or do you think it's the exercise as well? I mean, what do you think makes that work for you?
I think, you know, when I put myself into a position where I'm able to go out and do something for an extended period of time, I find that as I get further along that process, my mind becomes simpler and I feel more content with what's going on inside of my brain and going on inside of my body. So it helps me to kind of remember what's important in life and not get caught up into things that sometimes can sidetrack you in life. It makes me go out to these places and have these quiet internal dialogues where I just kind of cement what I feel, what I want my life to be like, you know, what type of people I want to associate with. You know, I'm a deep thinker. And so I go out there just to really find some peace that it's hard for me to find in just day-to-day life. I'll be honest with that.
I like that. It's a wonderfully healthy way to combat depression, I would say.
You know, I would say too. Trust me, I tried numerous other things, and I found this to be the most. Now, are there people that probably take it too far, and it's probably not the healthiest thing? Well, sure, of course, but at the same time, you know, the vast majority of folks would probably be doing something else to a really nth degree, if not for running. So I look at that as a healthy alternative to some of the other things that aren't necessarily healthy for you.
Right. Well, you know, I have learned about myself. Now, I'm not an ultra-distance runner. I could never claim that title. Wouldn't work. But I have found about myself, I have to get out. And what I mean by that is I need to be outside and moving somehow. So, you know, we climb 14ers, and we do a lot of mountain biking and backpacking and whatever other event, you know, maybe it's canoeing down a river, but I have to be out and active. And if I don't do that regularly, then, man, I start to slip into the doldrums. You know what I mean?
Yes. So you understand, and I'm no different than you in that way. That's exactly how I am. In fact, my wife will sometimes just go, please go out on a run. You know, please go, you know, or please go do a race this weekend. You know, and she just finds that you know, the patience isn't where it needs to be. And I get out and I kind of feel like you get out there and you just kind of remember who you were supposed to be. And you kind of feel like that's the only way I can feel childlike in this life. You know, like when I'm turning a bend in a canoe and I don't know what's around the corner, I have anticipation and I have an excitement that I vividly remember having when I was a kid exploring and doing new things. And so, like I said, in day-to-day life, when you're running around and you're dealing with insurance and taxes and, you know, and traffic and tickets and all these things, it's this beautiful time for me where I'm just like, okay, this is who I am. I can deal with this other stuff if I can sneak out and do this. And so I'm just right there with you, and I'm glad you understand that. And I'm sure a lot of people do. And I don't care whether you hike or bike or run ultras. Again, I don't look at titles. You know, people that get outside, I'm fired up by.
Right. Do you prefer Pete or Peter?
I like Pete. My mom called me Peter. She's not around anymore. She's like, I named you Peter. I didn't name you Pete. If I wanted you to be named, you know, people to call you Pete, I would have named you Pete. But, like, you know, she's not around, and I always like Pete better. So let's take Pete.
All right. Know. Well, Pete. I don't know if you know much about this or not, but I've heard it, and I would be curious what your opinion is. I have heard people, Pete, say that when people use adventure sports to feel good, like we're talking about right now, that may or may not last, or they have to keep doing the sport for it to work. And then they say what you really need to do is, like, meditate more or pray more.
Yeah.
Or maybe what you really need to do is to learn how to focus on being in the now and being fully present all the time. And I kind of hesitate, you know, because I'm like, well, if it works, it works. But what's your perspective on that?
I agree with it 1,000. I mean, in fact, We haven't even talked about the Iditarod, but the 1,000-mile race that I went through was a testament to that, to meditation, to quieting your brain, you know, because in general, I have what's – now, understand, and you can probably already tell, there's a lot going on with me, right? There's a lot of angles. There's a lot of thinking going on, and so it probably wouldn't shock you to know that I have a psychologist that I've worked with for years here in Asheville, who's a dear friend of mine at this point, but he helps me, and he's quick to point out, and I've been working on this for a long time now, that when I first started seeing him, I was a professional at beating myself up over things that have happened in my past or things I wish I didn't do or things I wish I would have taken a different road or looking back and just having anguish. Or if I'm not in that world, I'm in this world that I want to be way over here and I want to do this. But to get here, I have to do this, this, this. And I'm planning for years down the line. So I was a professional at either being 10 years behind me or 10 years in front of me without any inkling to this second.
Oh,
right,
man.
Now.
Yeah, I hear you.
It was an epiphany. I've been listening to like deep spiritual teachers and like Eckhart Tolle and a few other folks about just what we're talking about. But it never quite resonated with me until this year on the Iditarod Trail, where I was stripped away from all ego, you know, because I'm just out there by myself and there's just nothing. You just have yourself. And then all of a sudden I started listening to these, you know, my spirituality and my Christianity, and then listening to these spiritual teachers. And then all of a sudden thinking, wow, like it opened up a door to the present to me that had been dormant for decades. And it's like, it's opened up my life to, and my wife will tell you, it's changed me as a person since I've been home. And it's not like it's not like I'm there. I still find myself getting sucked in and thinking, but it's like once I go down those other roads, I don't go down them too far before I realize, hey, get back to now. You know, I sense myself going one way or the other, and I just say, okay, back to your breath, back to where you are and who you're around this second, rather than thinking of it as a springboard to any. you probably opened up a can of worms asking that question, because it's like, see, this is what I want to talk about. Like, this is it for me. Like, we could, you know, I would rather talk about this than the hard details of the Iditarod 10 times. This is just the stuff that transcends sports and transcends the humanness of this. And so, yeah, I totally agree with that statement. And that's why all along I didn't know what I was searching for through all those marathons and all those ultras and all those wilderness treks. And then it just all came together to be like, that's what I was searching for. That's what I needed to get to. It's just now.
Isn't that something?
The
thing that's hardest to grasp is the easiest thing of all sometimes.
I know. And to think I went so long where it's, and I call it having monkey mind, where I was just attached to every thought that went through my brain, and I had to chase it down the trail and see where it fit in. And it's just like a weight lifted off my shoulders once it all came together, to where it's just like, all you have is now. That's really all you have control over, you know? And so it just kind of, you know, as you can see, I'm pretty freewheeling. I'm just more comfortable with who you are in your own skin. You know, you're just like, I am who I am right now, and I might change and I might still mess up, but it's been the best thing in my life and transcends the Iditarod for sure.
Well, there's several thousand people that just heard you say that, and I think that that's a beautiful testimony. You know, there's a reason for the Adventure Sports Podcast. It wasn't just for the sports or the fun, you know, certainly not for hedonism. The reason we started this show is because we believe that people like yourself who go out and do these things, you know, you've been up the mountain, you're coming back down, and you're sharing it with the rest of us. How about that?
Absolutely. And I think we all have our mountain. I'm not going to lie. I truly believe that we all have our mountain that we're trying to climb and see the other side of. So, you know, we need inspiration from each other through this process, you know, and Lord knows I've had inspiration by thousands of people before me. So as I just look at myself as just like anyone else who's strapping on a backpack or putting a canoe on top of their, you know, I'm no different. I don't feel myself different with anyone in that realm, because I do look at it as that's what we're all trying to find out there. And luckily we still have places that are wild enough to where we can get away. We can find those things in those places.
Oh yeah. Well, let's dive into your 50 marathons in 50 states just a little bit. Now, were these official events where you were in races, or were these events that you set up where you said, I'm going to run my 26 miles on Tuesday?
Ultimately, I wish that would have been the way I would have done it, because I really got burnt out on the race scenario. You know, I would have rather just go to some trailhead and you go run 26.2 miles in that state. But when I was going through it, I was really type A about it, and I was running marathons. I will tell you that, and you'll understand this, like, you know, I started out, and it's funny, if you look, I have this board that's got all the marathons I've run, and it's got all the medals and stuff, and you look at how it started, and it's like all these big city marathons, and then very quickly you see them start to become just very smaller cities to towns to podunk marathons where there's hardly anybody there, because that was what I was about. You know, after I very quickly realized I didn't like running in big crowds, and I didn't need a lot of people around me, and I didn't necessarily need big medals when I was finished. I just, again, was after the experience. And so I was just like finding these really one-off cool marathons where, you know, where it was just like you could stay at the host hotel and it's right across the street from the start line, and then you can, you know, you can finish and take a shower and you don't have to take taxis. And so it went from city to rural pretty quickly in the 50 states. But it was and then, like I said, that those kind of led to running longer distances towards the end of those, because I was just like, these are getting old. I can do these, you know, with my eyes closed. You know, it's just, it doesn't feel like I'm pressing too much. Now, I'm not saying they were all fast. Like, I mean, a lot of them were just grunts, right? But I just knew I could get through them by hiking or jogging if I had to and all that. So it's, it was, I raised $62,000 for cancer research by doing the 50 marathons in 50 states. And so that was a promise to my mom that I made good on. So that was a big part of that process.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Now,
yeah,
I'm going to just go, since we're talking about the psychology side of things a little bit, I'm going to stay there just a little bit. So you raised $62,000 for cancer research, and that's a beautiful thing. Yeah, people would applaud you for that, right?
Yeah.
Did that lead to some sort of self-actualization and fulfillment long-term for you personally?
That's a good question. I don't often have to take some time to think about an answer. Usually I'm pretty versed in these. That made me realize that I loved raising money for a good cause, but I'll tell you like this, because you have to understand this about the process. So I raised $62,000 for Komen, right? Komen, as everyone knows, it's the number one huge place that raises money and funds for breast cancer research. Now, I raised $62,000. Well, I'll tell you, I had no idea where that money went. I had no idea if that money was going to help people, or if that money was being, you know, spent towards $62,000 worth of pink balloons that we're going to put all over cities that we go. And that frustrated me,
right?
You know, and it was great, and I loved raising that money, but kind of having an epiphany towards the end of that, like, I want to raise money on a much more local level. I want to make an impact where I live, because I just feel it more important than thinking on this global level. I think it's more important that a lot of people dig into where they're living. And so I started raising money for a local nonprofit, which is just like where the rubber meets the road. Like,
yeah,
they're really doing a really good work, and you're seeing $500 that you raise is taking care of one lady in Western North Carolina for an entire year through their program. And so you're like, well, yes, I need to do this. Like, this is how I want to raise money. And then you see that money going to work in your own, and you have fulfillment there. I did not have fulfillment watching the money just go to some huge corporation where I lost track of how it affected people. So that I had to put that, you know, that's important for me personally. Do I have something wrong with Komen? Absolutely not, right? You have to understand that. But for me on a personal level, I didn't find fulfillment until I saw it making a difference.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
So that's kind of what I was getting at, and I'm really glad you made that distinction. Now, I say this, I think we need to continue to support the big research foundations as well. I mean, it's got to happen. But that said, isn't there something wonderful about when you contribute to a cause, you can see the impact? You get the feedback. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, you can, I mean, I've been in situations where I've met some of these ladies that have been affected by what, you know, by what I've done and what I've raised. And to me, it, again, yes, I totally agree that, and I feel like if more of us did that, we would be better off globally, because a lot of us were taken care of locally, and that looks better all the way around. I just feel like, you know, it's the same kind of thing when people go, oh, I want to do service work, so I got to go to Africa. Well, it's like, no, go to Cleveland. You know what I mean? Go to Detroit. You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't always need to be this extreme thing to raise money on this big level. I'm an advocate for grassroots organizations and really making an impact locally. So,
cool.
Yeah, that's kind of what that, all that money. I'm glad it probably did do a lot of work, but it kind of was a learning experience for me to realize that I wanted to go about things in a different way. And I've raised some good money since then for this Hope Chest in Asheville, which is just a very small 501c3, you know, just teeny here in Asheville, but they do good work, and that's who I'm stuck with now. So it's
Right on. Well, you know, I want to get to the Iditarod, but I'm trying to piece together the journey that led you there a little bit. We've already talked about the 50 marathons in 50 states. I mean, obviously, every marathon has its own story, right? But let's do this. Could you give us a highlight, an experience that was really positive that came out of those 50 marathons? And then also, give us a story, second, about when something didn't go right. It was just really, really killer in those 50 marathons. And then we'll move on to the Iditarod.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds great. As far as like a really awesome story, I would say, you know, I told you I was running all these city marathons, but you know, before that time I had all this outdoor experience in the mountains, right? But here I am running these city marathons, and then I'm going out to Oregon, and there's not, at the time there wasn't a ton of marathons in Oregon. So you had your choice of maybe five or six or something like that. Now I needed to do Oregon in a certain amount of, I was going out west. I wanted to knock this out. So I had to look at certain period of time. Well, there was a trail marathon. It was called Holland Aspen. I love the name of it. And it was a trail marathon in Bend, Oregon. And I ran it with one of my best friends. I used to have friends come join me at the marathons, and I'd hang out with them for the weekend and we'd run a race. But we ran this trail marathon, and we were about halfway through the race, just running through these big, pretty spruce trees, or, you know, just very northwest type trees, and just thinking, wow, feeling like kids. And I just remember thinking, what in the hell have I been doing with all these city marathons like this thing? Because it was just this epiphany, like, I don't ever want to run one of those city marathons again, ever. I mean, those don't do anything for me. And then after that, you can kind of see how that, like, the trail and ultra stuff started organically growing in me, because I was just like, this seed hit me when I first ran. Now that was probably 30 marathons into the project, right? So it was just, it needed to be on its own time. And so that was a really fun epiphany moment for me. And then a lot of fun trail marathons came after that. So that was kind of where I found my traction. And then as far as bad experiences, I'll tell you one. I was running the trail marathon in New Jersey. And I remember it being the middle of winter. I think it was January in New Jersey. It was this loop course, and there were not many people out there. And here I was like 17 miles of the way through the race. And I knew the course because it was a loop. So I knew kind of what you had to do. And I knew in my heart that here I was at this tiny junction where if I would have just taken a quick right, I could have jumped on the trail and probably got ridden of like 3 or 4 miles of the trail. And there was no one between me, you know, there was no one in front of me or behind me that would have ever known what I was doing. And I'm telling you, Kurt, I sat there for a second and I was like, and I looked, I looked at it, you know, and I was like, everything in me, because it was nasty weather, it was raining, I was in New Jersey, which to me was not the most, you know, stunningly beautiful state I've ever been in, and I'm just trying to get through this, and I see this little corner I could cut, and I just remember vividly thinking that that looks very enticing and intriguing to me. And then I thought to myself, the very next thought that came through my mind was, hey, Pete, how great would you feel if all of a sudden you finished 50 marathons in 50 states and you raised $62,000 in cancer research, but all the while you know in the bottom of your heart that you cheated on one of them.
Oh.
And I was like, and just like as fast as I looked down that trail, I just turned left and went and looped around those few miles and just realized that, like, I had some integrity and there was, you know, it was like, it was just one of those moments where I'm like, okay, I'm in it for the right reasons, because if I'm not, then I cheat and I get through it and nobody knows and I go on with my life and I you know, fool. But it was just one of those moments where I'm like, nope, I'm going to do this the right way. And so it was another cool moment. And I would say a positive moment that kind of came from a negative moment, if you will. And I think a lot of people probably wouldn't admit that they looked down that road, but dang, I took a nice long gander down that little connector trail there, you know.
Well, sometimes the shortcuts are not shortcuts. Can you imagine having to deal with that? Thinking, oh, waking up in the middle of the night, I never finished that one.
I know. And you're just like, why? Like, what was the point, right? Like, you got done a half hour earlier so you could get back to your hotel room to do what? Watch SportsCenter? You know, it's just like, no, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to do that. So it was cool. It was like a certifiable, legit 50 marathons in 50 states and I was happy, you know, and at certain points it felt like the biggest thing in the world to be in the middle of. But now I look back on it and I'm like, well, that's cute, you know, one marathon a month and you know, with 7 aid stations and, you know, it's just, I've been through some darker, deeper places now. And so it's like, I look back and I'm like, yeah, that's pretty cool, but not certainly anything that's, really super deep or anything, just kind of knocking it out to raise some money, you know.
Well, I already said the Adventure Sports Podcast is not just about adventure sports and fun, right? We learn something about ourselves when we do these things, don't we?
Yes. Whether you're an elite or you're a back of the packer or the middle of the packer, we all have similar experiences and we're all searching for similar things. So it's just like, I love my tribe of outdoor people, and you're right there, you know, just an awesome group of people that are regularly told they can't do things or, you know, you shouldn't, and just find ways to have that mental fortitude to go out and keep being outside and keep progressing. And, you know, in a world where everyone tells you that you got to sit inside and you don't want to get hurt and you don't want to get beat up and you got to be this and that, it's just like, I know who my people are, you know. It's a great, I love the outdoor sports world. It's awesome.
That's cool. So you did your 50 marathons in 50 states and then you realized that you preferred the smaller towns and then you realized you preferred the trail running. And
yep.
Then this started leading to ultra marathons, ultra distance runs.
Right.
Well, just before we dive into the ultras, I'm curious, you had done so much running, you're obviously in great shape. When you switched to being on trails instead of on the asphalt, then did you have to change your training technique or your running technique? How was that different?
First of all, I think I have I'm not going to say pretty strong, I have a very strong mind. Sometimes I can get away with not being the most trained person by just being the most dogged person and the person that refuses to give up. So I feel
right.
I have that in spades. But as far as, like, if you went to downtown Asheville, you could very easily get 100 people that run more than me and train harder than me. And again, like, this is important to me, but it's not my life. Like, I'm a stay-at-home dad. I have a wife. I have my faith. I have other sports I enjoy doing. So I get my kicks a lot of different ways. But like you, just as long as it's outside, I'm good. I just started getting further and further because I was interested in kind of seeing, like, you know, what I could do. Those marathons, I know I can do those, okay? And so, like, doing them repetitively is not proving anything new to me. And right. so it was just a very natural progression to me to start running the distances. But I was good because, you know, a lot of people mess up and they try and run long distances too fast. So I really like took my baby steps building up to each distance that I ran, except for the 1,000.
Except for the 1,000. I mean, good grief. How can you even go there? I mean, when people say, oh, I ran 1,000 miles. What? It just that's mind-boggling, you know? So you mentioned before I hit record here that on the Iditarod, there's a 350-mile run, and then there's the 1,000-mile run. And so you worked your way first by doing the 350 and then worked your way on up. You've got it. You've got to walk us through that a little bit. How did that all transpire?
I thought when I was running all these marathons and ultras that, you know, I started, and I love looking back at this time because I feel like talking about myself 6 years ago is like a lifetime ago in certain regards because I'm on this path, you know, and so it's like I look back to that time when I thought that because I had run all these marathons and I'd finished all these ultras that I somehow deserved to go and do this huge Iditarod Trail Invitational. Like, it cracked me up because I wrote this impassionate letter to the race director after I heard about it, just like you did. I read an article. I'm like, what is this? Are you kidding me? People do this? I have to do this. There's no other way I can live my life without doing this race. And so I contacted the race director via email. Like, when I want something, I'm a bulldog, right? So I just went right to the source. Right as the race was going on, I was emailing back and forth to the race director, telling him that in so many words, he was like, man, your 50 marathons don't mean shit up here. I'm just going to throw that out there. You know, he's like, that does not equal any preparedness for coming to do the Iditarod in the middle of winter. I just want you to know that. But by the way I wrote my letter, he could tell that I was totally old school. Like, I was real romantic. I was like, I will appreciate all the times I have on the trail, whether it's great or bad. And, you know, just like really cheesy and romantic about it. But he took it for what it was, which was an honest plea. And he's like, you need to come up and do this race. So like 10 minutes after I heard about it, I was invited the following year to come do it. And so I go up my first year, and it's just, I cannot tell you how over my head I was. I mean, I tell people regularly, my first year I got last place. I love saying that. Because my first 350-mile race in 2014, there were 12 finishers in the 350-mile race. I was 12. I had a 92-pound sled that I hauled. Oh. The winner had a 16-pound sled. They say your first year on the Iditarod Trail, you pack all your insecurities with you. Right. Well, I packed 92 pounds of insecurities into my sled that I hauled. I got lost 25 miles the first day. And I blistered my feet toe to heel the second day. So within 48 hours, I had made all those mistakes and pretty much wanted to tuck tail and get back to Carolina and just admit that I was way in over my head. But because of who I am and because of my genes, I turned my back and fought north and made my way another 330 miles by myself because everyone else was all the way in front of the race at this point with me getting lost and having to find my way back. So that was my first year.
Wow.
So I love saying that because I don't want people to ever hear a podcast with me and go, oh, yeah, Pete won the Iditarod in 26 days, and he's the Iditarod champ. Well, yes, I am, but I also was last place in the Iditarod. So don't think it's this glorious thing. I mean, I had to put all my effort into learning and regrouping many, 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 many times. So it's been a big path. Second year, I did third place. I got three. My first year was 10 and a half days. My second year was 6.5 days. So 12th place to third place in 1 year, just because I trained and I learned. I was realistic with what I needed to learn, and I did that. I didn't need anyone to coach me or tell me. I just went about the business of learning to be more efficient. And then I thought I was ready for the 1,000-mile race. And so in 2016, I tried my first 1,000-mile Iditarod and had a 200 miles into the race. I had a terrible accident where I fell. I was walking over a river that was open underneath, but it had ice on top of it. and I fell through the ice into open water that was trying to rush me under the glacier. And so it was, it was a near-death experience on the Iditarod Trail in 2016 for me. I've probably come closer to death than anybody else in the Iditarod ever, regardless of whether it's a sled dog race or human-powered race. And so it was. And I went 300 more miles after the accident because I was not hurt, but mentally I was hurt. I was flustered. And I got 300 more miles and quit halfway through the race that year because I just didn't have it. I did not have another 500 miles in me. I got to the Yukon River. I was like, I'm out. I'm flying home. Which led to last year, which another, I call it a failure. I survived. I got through minus 60 on the trail. We dealt with minus 60 on the trail last year, and only four people finished the 350-mile race, which I was one of, but no one went on to Nome after that. So that's two straight years of failure, you know, not reaching my goal when I told you all along that that's what I've been doing all along. So this is finally like, you know, I wanted to find something that punched back. Well, here it is. And so I went back this year, and I considered it like I told you, I was good at ball sports growing up. I figured I was a baseball player, and I had two strikes against me. And that's the mentality I took to this year. Like, I'm going to finish this thing. I'm not striking out. And that's what led to the success I had this year, which was winning the Iditarod. So.
Wow. Well, first of all, congratulations. And I just,
thank you.
Man, I'd love to hear more about that experience. So, boy, where to start? Let's come back to this year later, because I want to talk more about how that felt. But we need the details about a lot of stuff to go with this, but I can't let that just hang there where you fell through the ice into the fast-moving river. Give us that story in detail, because I got to hear about that. That's crazy.
All right. I'm well versed in the story. It's like, you know, when I start telling it, I sometimes get bumps on my arms and I sometimes get emotional because it's just an emotional part of my life. I vividly remember everything about it. And so I'm not going to take a half hour to explain it. I'll just kind of go over the details. But more or less, I came down off Rainy Pass, which is the highest point in the Iditarod. And so you're going up over the same mountain range that Denali is in. And then you're coming down over the other side, and you're going into the most dangerous section of trail on the entire Iditarod Trail. So during the 1,000-mile race, this 4-mile stretch of river, the Tatina River, is the most dangerous section. Everyone knows it. Everyone has felt super sketched. And the reason why is there's always open water. It doesn't matter if it's 40 below zero. There's always rushing water that you hear, that you see. And you're on little, almost like a snowmobile track. Like, you're following other people's tracks that kind of circumnavigate these open waters. And so, and also, we're a week before the sled dog. Now, when the sled dog, like a couple days before the sled dog race happens, people go and they fix the trail and they make sure it's in bomber shape and nothing would ever happen. But we're going a week before the trail. So we're kind of, we're just going at it like it's just like any other day. No one's been really looking after the trail. So I was going into this dangerous, most dangerous section. I was by myself. It was getting to the sun had gone down. It was getting to be evening. I had promised myself that if I get into a situation that I don't feel comfortable, I'm just going to sit down, make a fire, and I'm going to wait for the next person to come up behind me. And then we're going to go and do the section together. So at least there's a hope of rescue if something were to happen. But I was 3 miles, 3.5 miles-ish from the checkpoint that I knew was there. And all of a sudden I was in this place where I just stood at the before I went up and over this river where there's ice on top of it. And I just thought to myself, this looks like the most dangerous place I've ever been in my entire life. It just had this eerie feeling to it. And I just stopped, and that says enough in itself that I stopped on the trail just to kind of take stock of what the situation was. And so I looked, and if I were to just keep going straight, the trail goes, and then it goes into open water. It looks like the open water is about thigh deep. So I would have to pull up my waders that I have in my sled and then may or may not have water going over the waders as I'm crossing over that water. And I just was And, you know, I want him to get to the checkpoint, tired, hungry, sick, tired, everything you'd think I was. And everything in me was just like, just keep moving. Like, it was almost impossible for me to stop, even though I knew it was dangerous. Well, I looked right for a different place to go because I didn't want to go straight. I looked right. That looked 10 times more dangerous than straight. Then I look left, and I see one set of tracks that goes up and left over the river. And then I look at the marks, the snowshoe marks, hit back up with the trail. And so I was like, well, there it is. That's the route I need to take. But I saw it to be a little thinner than the main trail. And so I was doing this hole where I had my trekking pole and I was trying to make it fail. If you I'm trying to hit it in front of yourself. I'm punching it. And every time I punch and feel it thick, I take another step and I'm punching it until I make it fail so I can step back. Well, as I was doing that, I got to about the midpoint of the river, and this was a pretty wide river. And just before I could almost blink, there was 100% failure with the bridge I was standing on. And so everything swept under my feet, and luckily I got one last breath before I went underwater. But all of a sudden, I'm underwater, and water's moving sideways to try and take me under the ice. And so I'm getting back up. I get back up, which some people never do, to the surface. I get back up to the surface, and then I'm just flailing. I mean, I've caught, like, shocked and everything, and my adrenaline and all that. And so I'm trying to crawl out of the ice that I fell in. But every time I try and crawl out, I fracture another piece of ice, and I'm back swimming where I was. And so it's just numerous attempts at trying to get out of the river that I almost gave my life to. And then finally, and I tell people that it was the only way I can explain it was almost if you've seen footage of like a walrus and how a walrus like breaches ice, like they just get a little bit of their body on and then they're like just wiggling and trying to get more of it on. And I think finally I was just able to get enough mass onto the ice where I was able to wiggle everything. Now, granted, my sled is behind me and ice and it's in water, but I get out of that. But very quickly realized that, okay, I got out, but now I'm freezing. You know, now I'm in temperatures of probably 0 degrees. I have a sheet of ice over everything on my outer shell. But I realized that my inner, like my base layers are just wet. They're saturated, but they're not frozen. So my outside layers were frozen, but my base layers were just wet. And so, like, almost right away, I made the decision that I'm just going to run to make it to the checkpoint. And so once I got out and got my wits about me, I just took off. Now, I was going over dangerous spots again, but I was running. I was literally running to stay warm until I got to the next checkpoint. And then I go in and all hell breaks loose. You know, it's like next thing you know, the news is wanting interviews and whatnot and trying to follow me down the trail and all this. And I'm just like, no, I'm trying to sneak away from not having to do any of that stuff, but I get back on the trail. And like I said, just getting through that was just too much for me to keep going. I look back on that. I cannot freaking believe I went another 300 miles after that, but I did. And then I quit. And I just, like I said, that was that. I mean, it was just, it rocked me how close I was.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
Oh, that is scary stuff, man. That would not be a fun experience at all. It's an amazing thing to listen to, but to think about you in that extreme cold and trying to claw your way out of the ice as it keeps breaking, you've got a current there, hypothermia setting in, and you did the right thing. I don't think under the circumstances, I don't see how you could have gotten warm again had you not just kept running. I think that's probably what saved your life.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I had to, I am so glad because like I've talked to a lot of friends that have a lot more experience in Alaska backcountry than I do. And they look back and they say, Pete, you made every single right decision in dealing with that situation. And that's why they That's why they wanted me back. That's why, because they realized that it was fluky what happened, but I self-rescued, and I got right. myself out of the situation by making sound judgment calls. If I were to make a fire, I would have had to taken a huge knife and just cut my sled open because it had an inch of ice around it. You know right. what I mean? So it's just, and then you're just dumping fuel and probably burning just clothes that you have. I mean, it's just, so I made the right decision, and that was the scariest moment of my life, to say the very least. It's not the only time I've been close, but it was by far the closest I've ever been to passing away. And so it took a lot for me to get back up there the next year. You know, my wife was a big part of that, helping me to wrap my head around the experience and you know, coming to talk to my girls and tell them that daddy's going back and stuff. So I'm pretty vested in this Iditarod race, man. It's a pretty cool story all the way through, especially that I'm sitting here pinching myself, looking at, you know, trees moving and things. I'm alive. It's beautiful.
Right. Well, for the listeners, yeah. I want to throw out there, if you had another person there, and you had a dry sleeping bag, and you could have gotten out of those wet clothes and shared a sleeping bag, that would have been the second way to save your life.
Yes.
You know, and I want everyone to know that, because that would be probably the first protocol. But because you were alone and everything's wet and iced, I think what you did is probably what kept you alive. I don't know that you would have ever gotten warm enough, you know?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, you know? And it's funny, because at that point, like the last 2 years, I've had a sat phone, and I didn't that year. So even if I would have had, you know, gotten out, and I couldn't have called anyone to come get me.
Right.
I literally would have had to wait for, and who knows? I had no idea how close the next person was behind me. They could be 20 miles behind me. There's no guarantees that someone's coming up behind you to help you, especially out in the middle of Alaska.
So. Right.
I was happy, and that was a big building block to having the confidence that you know, knowing that you made sound decisions and getting through it made me feel that I could go back and probably do the same thing if something else came up. And then, of course, the next year something else does come up, and I deal with, you know, getting through minus 60. And not, when I say minus 60, I'm saying you're traveling when it's minus 60. Like, you're heading into the north wind and minus 60 Ooh. Below, and you're going 30 miles to the next checkpoint, and you know you're not stopping. And so that's as committed as it gets. And people will say, are there races tougher than the Iditarod Trail Invitational? No, because of the weather factor. Because of the weather factor.
That's the granddaddy, huh?
Tough races. Yeah, in my opinion, yes. I don't think, I mean, because the stakes are so high. You know,
right.
that's, to me, that's why it's so tough.
Well, let's talk about the success now. The 1,000-mile race that you completed and won. Walk us through that story a little bit. And I want to know also about the routine of it, what a day is like.
Absolutely. I've probably done roughly over 2,000 miles on the Iditarod Trail in my lifetime. So I've many, many days. And so a day in the life of the Iditarod Trail Invitational is half of the time you can get to checkpoints and you can get, you know, you can get into a lodge and you can get food and shelter and water and you can have all those things, and it's great. And so sometimes you wake up and you're in a bed and there's a roof over your head and there's food that you can buy and there's, you know, all these plugs for your electronics. That's half of the time. Half of the time you're waking up on the side of the Iditarod Trail and it's 25 below. And you're 41 years old and your back's hurt and you wake up and you have to go to the bathroom and you realize that you have to put all your stuff away back into your sled as fast as you can. And you can't use your hands because it's so cold. So you have to wear your gloves. But then when things happen where you have to use your fingers and have the dexterity, well, you do those things for 10 seconds and then you put your gloves on, warm them back up. Then you take them back off and you work on it. And so anything you do is just hard. And so mornings are brutal getting up on the trail. Obviously, if you're in a checkpoint, it's much different. But most of the time, you find yourself on the trail. So you get up, and really, you just get going as fast as you can. Like, I'd like to think that you stay and you make a mountain house meal and you make a breakfast and you go to the bathroom and you stretch. And it's nothing like that because it's so cold. you know, you're like shaking, waking up, like, oh my gosh, I gotta get going, I gotta get going, I gotta move so I can warm myself.
Wow.
And so you're just throwing all your stuff into your sled. Doesn't matter how it goes in there, just you need to get it in there and get moving. And then you turn your back, you put your harness on, and you start hauling your sled down the trail. And for me, my style is just to go. I'll haul two rock climbing chalk bags off of my harness, and I'll fill those chalk bags with a bunch of bars and beef jerky and peanuts and trail mix and all this stuff that you would think on trails that you'd eat. And then I'd fill those up, and I'd have a bladder of water on my back that I've kept on my back all night so it's not frozen. And then so I get all that ready, and then I'm gone. So I might not stop again for the next 10 hours. And so I'm just burning down the trail. I'm not running. I'm hauling a 40-pound sled behind me. So I call it power hiking. And what that means, more people will understand if I talk in these terms. If I can get to 4 miles an hour, I am flying. Like, yeah. I feel like I'm really efficiently moving, and that's 15-minute miles. Now, most of the time, I'm not there. You know, most of the time, it's more like 20-minute miles, so 3 miles an hour. Sometimes it's 0.2 miles per hour because you're in 2 feet of snow. But, you know, on a given day, if the trail's in good shape, you know, you're moving 3.5 miles an hour. So you go 10 hours, you've gone 30 miles. Now, I average 38 miles a day on my trip. So what that probably averaged out to is about 18 or 19 hours of work on my feet every single day, all day.
That's a lot.
And then 4 to 5 hours off my feet. But that doesn't mean sleep. Like, a lot of people are like, oh, so you get 4 or 5 hours of sleep. No. you're messing with tons of gear. Your mind is thinking about checkpoints. You're checking your map to make sure you're on the right. You know, it's just, and then maybe you fall asleep and you get 2 hours of sleep. And so, you know, it's, you take sleep when you can get it, or when you're just falling asleep on your feet, that you've been hiking so long that you're literally falling asleep on your feet, realizing you need to stop. And so that's how hard I burn every single day on the trail. And then, you know, if you wanted, and what does that all mean? Here's a picture. I started the race at 205 pounds. I finished the Iditarod as 169 pounds.
Oh, man, that is wicked.
That's how hard I worked to do what I did out there. So I like I always want to make sure I don't paint some picture of what it's like out there, and it's just wonderful in this wilderness and beautiful mountains. It is everything you have inside you to keep moving forward and to stay warm and to keep your water from freezing. So it's just, like I said, it's just, you simplify everything down to food, water, shelter. And you're not thinking about much else other than those things. And then there's your meditation. That's your walking meditation right there.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So did you reach a point in this last race that you did finish? Did you reach a point where you thought, I'm not going to make it, I've got to stop? You ever get there?
You know, there was never a point where I didn't think I was going to make it. Okay, how do I say this? There was many times where I was like, I don't think I can do this, right?
Right.
But thinking is different than what you can do, right? Like, you know, it's just thoughts, right? So, like, that was my mind. Like, and it's a battle when I do these things about, what's your mind talking about and what is your body capable of doing? And I think people have no clue. I think, like, your average person has no idea how far they could push themselves because they're not willing, you know, any discomfort. And we're told that we need to stop and we need to fix it. And we, you know, you don't, it's not good to feel that. And I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum, you know? So I just beat myself up so much out there. And it just, like, it took my, every single thing I had inside me, whether spirituality or physicalness or mental or all these things, it took everything I had to finish this year. And I sit in awe. There's a guy that his name is Tim Hewitt, and he's done this race. He has gone to Nome on foot 9 times
wow.
in his life since the year 2000. So it boggles my mind that, like, I did it once, and I was like, oh, done. Like, just not even close to wanting to come back next year and do that again, let alone do it 9 times. I mean, talk about a different mentality. So there's just levels of people that know how to tell their mind to shut up.
Right.
You know?
Well, I could see if a person weren't in a hurry. So I could see how it could be fun to do a 1,000-mile winter trek, but stay within your comfort zone every day and maybe do it, I don't know, how long would it take to do it? A month, 6 weeks, whatever it is.
To take it real leisurely, and then maybe you'd even take a day off. Whoa! Let your body heal up a little bit.
But here you are trying to win the thing. So how many days did it take you, did you say?
26 days, 13 hours, and 44 minutes, from start to finish.
Wow. 26 days. Now, if you don't show up at a checkpoint, do they just assume, well, he's sleeping on the trail? I mean, is anyone ever looking for you,
No. I mean, more so these days there are, because finally we're wearing trackers. When I started doing this race, we did not wear trackers. And I literally feel that the reason the Iditarod Trail Invitational now uses trackers is because my family bothered the race director so much that year I was on the trail and they didn't know where I was on the trail.
Right.
And I have heard stories of how many times my sister called the race director and asked, is he okay? We haven't heard from, anyone and blah, blah, blah. And so, that was a little touch and go, and that really made a lot of nerves different. But now we wear these spot trackers to where people can see, right? So, like, for instance, this year, some guy got off track this year on a and he got, 20-something miles off track, right? Well, but the thing is that person's family and the race directors, they're watching this blue dot going off the trail and going further away from the trail.
Right.
So now all of a sudden you're thinking, okay, this guy is lost. He's going the wrong way and we need to get him. So this year I heard of someone that flew a plane. Everyone every other person in Alaska is a pilot, right?
Right.
So it's there's all these planes flying around, even though it's so cold and everything, but someone flew over this person and dropped out the window, like something that flew down to, made its way down, and it was a note. It was more or less like a note, like, dude, turn around. You're going 20 miles in the wrong direction. You got to turn around. You're going to, and then, boom, to say something about this guy, man, he said, okay. He turned around, he went the 20 miles back and finished the race. I was like, man,
nice.
There's a lot of people that would just be like, all right, well, have someone come get me on a snow machine, now that you know where I am. I mean, it's just amazing. If you're going and going and going and then all of a sudden you're not at a checkpoint, they're not sending out a search party.
Mm.
They're like, well, he's just taking time. He's catching up on his sleep or whatever. So, but I will say this year, in a race called the Yukon Arctic Ultra, which is kind of a sister race, if you will, to the Iditarod, a guy got off track, and then he didn't know where he was, and he made the killer mistake of taking his belt, his harness, and his sled off, and he left that somewhere, and then he went looking for the trail. So now he lost all his stuff.
Oh, no.
Not only that, but he decided that he was going to take his shoes off, and not only that, he decided he was going to take his gloves off. So the next day, and now granted, the sled with the tracker is right next to the trail. So everyone that's watching his dot is thinking that he's sleeping on the trail, whereas he is lost, has lost his shoes, and is, because he's completely dehydrated, he's not making sound decisions, and one thing compounds another. Next thing you know, he's lost his gloves and his shoes. Luckily, the next day, someone happened to be flying over and sees this person circling around in circles, sends someone down there, and his hands and feet are black.
Ugh.
100% frostbitten. That guy lost his hands and his feet this year in the race.
Oh, man.
And so, I mean, that's what I mean. Like, the stakes are freaking high. And it's like for me to say, oh, well, that guy, no, things get unraveled and you don't make good decisions when you cannot drink enough and eat enough to have, a strong mind. And so I can see how that can happen to somebody.
Absolutely. And hypothermia causes that. When your brain temperature drops, then your reasoning ability goes away. And it happens to a lot of people. Search and rescue
and
people.
They start stripping away.
Yeah.
Right? They start like taking layers off because they have this false sense of, I don't know. I've read a lot of the psychology of it, but it was like, man, this guy was, but I guess this guy was going around in circles screaming, thinking he's dying. I mean, obviously thinking that no one's going to find him and he's going to die this way.
Right.
And then luckily someone flew over and put a rescue together. But I mean, good
Lord.
I mean,
that's tragic.
Yeah, it really is. It truly is.
So the stakes are incredibly high. I mean, we get that. We've heard two stories here about how high the stakes are. You've really got to know your stuff. We're talking about extremely good at your outdoor skills and your outdoor winter skills, or you shouldn't even think about a race like this.
You're talking about putting them into the Arctic, where it's that race started at minus 50 Fahrenheit this year.
That's nuts.
Well, man, go do the 50 steps it takes before, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just going to say, you know, one time I had to hike out of the woods in the winter with ice all over me, and I had to hike deep into the night to get out to survive. And that was enough of an experience right there for me to just say, people, if you don't know what you're doing, don't do it. Go get your experience, you know, mind your P's and Q's.
Or go with someone that has experience, you know, like go on a trip with that person, you know, learn from them. Because like in my realm with us adventurers that have these skills, we're not hoarding these skills.
No.
We're not saying, oh, I know how to do this and how to take care of myself. And too bad you don't. You have to learn on your own. Most every single person I've been around is an open book. Like if someone's humble enough to ask how to go about stuff, you will give all your tricks that you've learned over all your hard years of screwing up, and then you want to present it to someone so they can make it better. So like be smart and use someone, you know, like, but just don't, you know, so many people, I see that ego just take over, and man, they want to prove that they can take on anything, you know, and do this. And I'm just tough. I can, and boom, those are the ones that are just liabilities out there. So yeah, there's a big difference between certain races, and I'm glad that I was a part of one that vetted a little bit more.
Well, I can say this much, you know, if you really want to prove that you can take on anything, then you probably can, but that means you gotta work up to it. Maybe do 50
Absolutely.
Marathons in 50 states and then get some adventure outdoor winter skills and then talk to someone that's lived in the Arctic for 10 years. And you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And it's like, when I see people take that path, it's so great, because I'm telling you, it can be so rewarding when you have the skills to be efficient out there, right? Like you realize that you have your systems and your systems are backed up. And
right.
You know how to take care of yourself. There, talk about a liberating feeling, because then you realize you can go and you can put yourself in these situations, you know, and you can take care of yourself. And especially if you're with others, you can look out for each other. But yeah, I see so much these days of just people that like, and it's just the same with like these entitled people that like, they don't want a starting job because they feel that they're better than that. Right.
Mm.
And it's like, all these people that don't want to hit these rungs on the way to the success that they have. And I see it far too often. And in certain regards, that's why I'm kind of like, I'm moving away from some of these races, because I'm just like, I don't want to really be a part of all this. You know, I'll just go do it on my own if I want to do it kind of thing.
Hey, we all pay our dues, but here's the beauty of it, right? The beauty of it is that's where the fun is.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily finishing the marathon that is the only thing that this is about. It's about all the stuff that went into getting the ability to run a marathon. And whenever you're challenging yourself, and that might be a walk around the block, but when you're challenging yourself and you overcome your limits and you grew as a person, then the reward is there. And if that takes you from a walk around the block to a 1,000-mile Iditarod race in the wintertime, you know, then fantastic. But be where you are, you know, and be who you are.
Yeah, but if it takes you from walking around the block to a 10K, heck yeah. I mean, good, you know, like, that's what I mean. Like, my Iditarod is my thing, but everyone has their thing, and you are spot on. And I can tell you've thought through these things, because many things you've said, I've realized that you don't get to this understanding without putting yourself out in a situation, like you said, you know, and that's the fun part, you know, and to me, that's adventure, of not knowing what's around the corner, but knowing that you'll be able to deal with yourself in a sound manner, you know, and not being a liability. And I mean, look at me, I'm a family man. I mean, I have a beautiful wife and two daughters. I want to be around for them. I want to be a grandpa, dang it. You know, it's like, I'm going to learn every skill I can to where I can return home after adventures like this. And so it's, and obviously it's touch and go, but I was looking for that line, you know, and I think I found it. I'm not just saying, I think I found it. I found that dang line, and now I'm kind of, you know, moving on a little bit from that type of adventure. Yep.
All right. Well, Pete, we got to hear what it was like to cross the finish line after 1,000 miles, find out you really are in first place and that you've done it. What was that like?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that, because, you know, I grew up reading about the Iditarod and reading the stories of Balto and then learning about Jack London and learning about all these awesome authors. And so, you know, I had been well-versed and obviously I'm into the psychology of things. I'm into the deeper things. And so I have tons of Iditarod friends, right? Like, I lived up there in Randolph for a while. I have many, many mushing friends. And anyone that's been to Nome in the sled dog race, I would always ask them, okay, what was it like when you got to Cape Nome and you look out and all of a sudden you see those lights of Nome? Like, what, tell me, you know, I'm always like picking their brains. Tell me what you feel. And, you know, there, some would say I start bawling, crying. There's others that say that they actually turn around and don't want to finish because they've become at such peace with themselves on the trail that they know the finish means going back to their other world, if you will.
Wow.
And so I was always loved these stories about this, right? And then I always would picture when I got to know them, because that was, dang it, that was my goal. And I thought for a long time it would be as a, you know, on a sled team and as a musher, but that didn't pan out. And so here I found myself, you know, and like knowing that it's going to be on foot, and all these thousands of times I thought what I'm going to say, who I'm going to thank, how I'm going to act, how emotional I'll be. And I just kind of knew, because I just know myself. So it's like, and oh my goodness, it was 180 degree difference than what I thought it'd be. It was like, I literally could, I got, first of all, a friend of mine and his friend, who I had never met, were the only two people at the finish line. This was at 4:30 in the morning. If my friend wouldn't have woken up and come out knowing that I was finishing and film it, nobody would have been at the finish line of this adventure for me. And I just think that's incredible. I mean, what an incredible adventure. And then obviously the people that are after it aren't after it for all the glory, because that's what we get to look forward to. Now, I won the race, right? Now, the guy that won the Iditarod sled dog race, he's instant fame. He won, I think, $65,000, and then like a $65,000 Dodge truck, like all tricked out Dodge truck. And
wow.
Then, boom, you're talking, you walk into sponsors, you go do speaking events, you've made your name for yourself for the rest of your life. What did I win for winning the Iditarod Trail Invitational? I won a finisher patch that I can put on a jacket. I got a t-shirt, like a finisher t-shirt. And then for winning, I got a homemade Iditarod coffee mug that says ITI champion on it. That's what I won for winning the Iditarod Trail Invitational 1,000-mile race.
Oh, Pete, that's hilarious, man. That is...
People love that. People love that story. They get a kick out of it. I don't get a kick out of it so much, because I'm like, man, I wish it wasn't such a discrepancy. But at the same time, as you can already know, I'm not lying when I say this. That was not what I wanted out of this whole Iditarod. It was that 5 years of plotting and failing and finishing and what that meant to me internally.
Right.
And as far as like what, you know, everything else is just different. And it doesn't matter to me. Like, that experience was what I was after. And obviously, because I'm doing that race and knowing that there's no fanfare. Now, is it changing a little bit? Yes. Have I gotten, like, am I doing this interview now? Heck yeah. And it's incredible. And I'm pinching myself. But like, it wasn't always that way for me. you know? And so, like, I'm the same person 5 years ago, you know what I mean, as far as my ego is not attached to this stuff. So it's just, again, I don't look at myself any different than the next outdoorsman. Like, this was an internal thing that I am just massively so happy that I'm done with, and I actually finished. I cannot believe. And then to win it, I mean, that was just like, that's just like, you got to be kidding me. You know, like, I mean, that's just like, you could, if you would have told me that 5 years ago, I would have laughed in your face. Like, you know, if you were to say, you know, when I'm having the 92-pound sled and I'm lost, if you were to come up to me and say, in 5 years, you're going to be the Iditarod champion, I would have literally thought of you as like Chris Farley. Like, I mean, like this, just no reality. And it's like, and to know what I've been through and then to know where I am now, it's just a spiritual path. And it's one I love sharing. And I love inspiring others by it, because I feel like people can get some things from my path. And it's not this like, yeah, check me out, 26 and a half days, first place champion. It's like, no, I love speaking to all the whole process, you know? So it's probably a little bit different than most athletes.
Well, and you do that too. You're a public speaker. And you,
right.
You have a slideshow that you share about this. You can be a motivational speaker. I think you do good as a keynote speaker. So anyway, that's something that you're willing to do, is to get out there and try to encourage people to find their own Iditarod, whatever that is, right?
And I mean, honestly, just hearing you say that gives me like, yes, that's exactly. I mean, that to a T. That's what I'm trying to put out to people, so they understand that. And you know, and then once they get to a point where they sit back and go, boy, 5 years ago, I didn't think I could go around my block. You know how many stories I've heard like that of people? I mean, thousands upon tens of thousands of stories of people that have said, when I started, I never thought I'd do this, and look at what I'm doing now. And I'm always like, well, stop for a dang second and look at where you've come from, please. Because I, you know, a lot of runners are, okay, I finished this, now I got to do this. And it's like, I always stop people and say, look at that path. And once you stop and look at where you've come from, that's the beauty. And that's where life is out there. Not in any of these reality shows or in any of these fake magazines and all this. Like, you know, I'll let the masses go that way. But I know what I get out of this stuff and the type of people that are attracted to these things. And this is my life. I'm in bed with this for the rest of my life, because this is the people I want to be around.
Yeah, absolutely. So, hey, what's next? You said, hey, I finished this one, so I can now say I'm done. But what's next?
Well, you know, I'm running Leadville on Saturday. What are we at? It's Monday now. This Saturday, I'm heading out to Colorado to run Leadville. So it's like, it's almost like I'm going back to who I was before all the Iditarod stuff took place, right? It's like, I'm an ultra runner. That's who I am. And I'm a family man. So I like, you know, going to baseball games with my families and taking my dogs on a hike. You know, it's just like, I'm not in a position, like a lot of people will say, what's next? And they go, well, you should go climb Everest. No, I don't want to climb Everest. Like, I 0% of me wants to go climb Everest. I look at that as a very ego-driven endeavor as well. And so I was like, if I were to go climb a big mountain, it would be one that was like three mountains away from Everest. That's huge, but no one knows the name of it. And no one, there's no fanfare. And I would go have the same experience that the people climbing Everest would, but I would do it on a no-name peak. And that would just be the type of stuff. So, but I have to give you a little bit of meat here. I do have one trip that I still see as something that I'd like to do, and that's, I would like to climb. I still have yet to climb Denali. I told you I was a big mountaineer before the Iditarod, and then I have to climb in front. I have to traverse the Denali numerous times in the Iditarod. And I just, as a man like me, I want to get to the highest point of the country that I'm raised in. So it's always been a dream of mine to climb Denali. But not only that, but I want to telemark ski down it too. So I think of this awesome, like, kind of expedition style mountaineering of, you know, where you're hauling your skis and you're maybe doing a couple trips up and down to haul gear and whatnot, but then getting to the top and just, you know, and just opening it up and skiing down. So that's something I'd like to do, Is that going to be anytime soon? I doubt it. I mean, it's another thing that I'm going to work towards. But right now, I'm just totally enjoying life. I love public speaking and sharing my story. I'm really trying to do better with that and put more energy into that because I enjoy it. And then I don't think you, and I've said this already in this interview, I don't think you can top from an adventure standpoint what I just did. And I don't say that from an ego perspective. I say that from a reality of what I've seen. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe there's something else huge out there waiting for me, and it's something that will come up. But right now I'm very content just being who I am and just being with my family and going to run ultras. And it's like when I go run Leadville, I'll just be right in the crowd, you know? I mean, no one will know me from everybody else in the race, and that's why I love it, you know? So it's like, it's fun. So I go, I'm just another racer in these races, you know? And so it's exciting. And it's just, and it's what I love to do. Again, it's just throwing myself out in the mountains. And so I'm a mountain man. I love adventure. I love sharing it with friends. And I'm just trying to live for the day. Like we both talked about for this moment, you know?
Very cool. Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the Adventure Sports Podcast and sharing with us what the experience was like of working up to the Iditarod and then finally completing it and winning it. Amazing stories. Congratulations again, and thanks so much for your time.
I'm honored to be on your show, and thanks for having me, Kurt.
Oh, you bet. And for all the listeners out there, you know, it may not be a 1,000-mile run in Alaska in the wintertime. That may not be your thing, or it might be your thing, but whatever it is, I say this at the close of every show, find a goal. Find something that you want to do and then start pursuing it because the benefits are limitless. Get out there and have some fun.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.